This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 8th of March, 2011, International Women's Day. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, International Women's Day is celebrating its centenary. We take a look at women's rights issues around the world. We go to Nigeria, where women are leading the struggle against the environmental and social problems caused by international oil companies.
We are losing our children. The men are losing their wives. The wives are losing their husbands. So we stood and said, no more. No more to violence, no more to conflict. We want peace.
In Cairo, a women's rights rally in Tahrir Square turns tense as men taunt and harass them. And we'll take a look at immigrant women in the US and the legal obstacles they face. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Airstrikes targeted Libyan rebels in the town of Ras Lanuf while tanks shelled the opposition in Sawiya and Benjawad. The number of injured is difficult to confirm, but hospitals are reportedly overwhelmed. The head of the opposition National Council in Benghazi told Al Jazeera they have called for the departure of Muammar Gaddafi within the next 72 hours. Nation members of NATO and the UN Security Council are discussing the possibility of military intervention by establishing a no-fly zone over Libya in reaction to aerial bombardments in the eastern part of the country. Tunisia now has an interim government in the wake of a popular uprising in January that ousted longtime President Ben Ali. The new cabinet is a mix of new faces and ministers from the old regime. As part of major reforms, the Interior Ministry has announced it will dismantle the apparatus of the State Security Department, a secret police agency accused of spying on political dissidents. Security forces in Tehran broke up a demonstration to mark International Women's Day. This as former President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani was removed from his top position in Iran's influential body of governing clerics. There also were questions regarding the whereabouts of two leading reformists, former presidential candidates Mir Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi. Some reports indicate Mousavi and his wife have been placed under house arrest. An International Women's Day rally turned deadly in Ivory Coast. Tensions have been high in the West African nation since the disputed outcome of November presidential elections. Troops loyal to President Laurent Gbagbo allegedly opened fire at today's rally in Abidjan, killing at least four. President Barack Obama signed an executive order Monday that will allow for the continued detention without charge of detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. The White House also announced the resumption of military tribunals there. The move drew criticism from human rights groups. Some Guantanamo detainees have been held for 9 years without charge. As a presidential candidate, Obama promised to close the controversial detention center. In Wisconsin, the standoff between the Republican governor and 14 Democratic senators continues, despite hints of a compromise. Molly Stenz reports from Madison.
Ads are flooding the airwaves in Wisconsin as national groups spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in media buys for and against Governor Scott Walker. Recall campaigns targeting all 16 eligible state senators are also gaining momentum. A senator must be in office for at least a year to be eligible for recall. In a press conference Monday afternoon, Governor Walker claimed he'd brokered a deal that would have the exiled Senate Democrats returning home. He blamed the legislature's Democratic leader, Mark Miller, for blocking it.
We had that agreement, we had the process to move forward, and then it all fell apart because Senator Miller is standing in the way. Increasingly, it seems certain that Senator Miller appears to be listening more to the labor union bosses from Washington than he is even from members of his own caucus.
But 11 of the 14 Senate Democrats who left the state to stall the controversial budget vote immediately fired back against the governor, calling his claim false and saying they aren't returning until he negotiates. Meanwhile, the Democratic Party has filed an ethics complaint with the state against the governor over information that came out of the prank phone call with a presumed donor. Protesters continue to camp outside the Capitol overnight in defiance of administration rules. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
A bill that would require women seeking abortions in Texas to undergo a transvaginal sonogram is headed for a final vote in the state's legislature. Supporters of the bill call it informed consent. Opponents call it invasive and aimed at humiliating women who choose not to carry their pregnancies to term. Language in the bill would require a pregnant woman to sign a sonogram certification form prior to obtaining an abortion. The form would be kept on record for 7 years. The bill is expected to easily pass the Republican-dominated legislature and has the support of Governor Rick Perry. Victims of rape will not be exempt from the procedure. And those are the headlines for FSRN. I'm Shannon Young.
I'm Danny Wood, in San Francisco. Today is the centenary of International Women's Day, and women's groups and activists all over the world are marking the occasion with rallies, debates, and activities. International Women's Day was celebrated officially for the first time in Austria, Denmark, Germany, and Switzerland in 1911, when more than 1 million people turned out to call for women's rights to work, vote, get an education, and hold public office. Although 100 years have passed, Amnesty International's Whitney Brown says many inequalities persist.
I think what's fascinating is both the combination of how many of the things that women are fighting for now were exactly why women took to the streets 100 years ago and created International Women's Day. And there has been progress, indubitably, but what is so clear is how uneven that process has been. And that's a combination of geography. There are areas of the world where women have much more equality than in other areas of the world. But I think when you look back at 100 years ago and then you look at what are the protests that are going on in places like the Middle East and North Africa region, women want the right to vote, for their work to be respected and recognized, and obviously to be paid for the work that they do. And again, what we see is women are generally working in the informal economy. They don't have labor rights protections, and they, even in countries that have an Equal Pay Act, for instance, like the England does, you still see pay differentials between men and women. So that's not changed.
The issues facing women around the world vary tremendously, from life-threatening sexual violence in the Congo to restrictions on participation in social and political life in Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, to pay inequalities and the attack on reproductive freedoms in the United States. As part of a campaign for gender equality by the group We Are Equals, British actress Judi Dench recorded this video for International Women's Day, where she assumes her role of M, 007's boss in the James Bond movies, and shares her views about gender issues with her charge.
Women are responsible for 2/3 of the work done worldwide, yet earn only 10% of the total income and own 1% of the property. It's not just about money and power. Every year, 70 million girls are deprived of even a basic education, and a staggering 60 million are sexually assaulted on their way to school. We're afraid to walk the streets at night, yet some of us are even more afraid to return to our own homes. At least 1 in 4 are victims of domestic violence. And every week, 2 women in the UK are killed by a current or former partner. So, are we equals? Until the answer is yes, we must never stop asking.
British actress Judi Dench in a gender equality video distributed by the group We Are Equals to mark this year's International Women's Day. Today, FSRN will look at women's rights in several countries, including the US and Nigeria, but first we go to Egypt. Egyptian activists had called for 1 million women march today in Cairo. But the demonstration in Tahrir Square turned violent when a few hundred women were drowned out by an equal number of men protesting angrily against their calls for equality. FSRN's Aya Batraoui has more.
A demonstration calling for greater political and social rights for women was expected to draw out thousands of people in Tahrir, or Liberation Square, which has become the hub of Egypt's protests. However, the peaceful women-led demonstration to demand equality and a greater role in politics turned violent, with the army firing warning shots into the air to disperse men who clashed with one another as a few hundred women were caught in the middle. A large crowd of men chanted against women's calls for equality, telling the women to go home, saying they have no place in politics. In a twist to the slogan, Down with the Regime, which was widely chanted throughout the anti-government protests that led to the recent ouster of President Hosni Mubarak, the opposing men chanted, Down with the Women. Voices on both sides drowned one another out. Some women reported being sexually harassed by the end of the demonstration. However, a number of women continued to chant, "Men and Women United," and sang the national anthem. Dr. Hoda Badran, who's the founder and president of the Alliance for Arab Women, said she felt women are being left out of the political process.
We are asking that women should participate in formulating the future. We are asking for a constitution which is secular. We are also asking that all the legislation should take account that women are equal with men. And we are calling that, when formulating a cabinet, women should not only be only one in the whole cabinet. Women should be represented by at least 30%, and afterwards to be 50% of the cabinet. And women should qualified woman should be allowed to be even the president of the country.
It was here on the issue of the presidency where nerves were rocked on both sides. Although women in Egypt were the first in the Arab world to gain the right to vote in 1956 and to secure the right to a higher education, the new constitutional amendments being drafted by a team of male judges suggest only a man can run for president. Sheikh Mohammed Ibrahim from the south of Egypt was in Tahrir Square observing the protest. He said he supports women as ministers and parliamentarians, but said a woman can neither lead a war nor the country.
Women should not be here at this time in Tahrir. They should hold a conference and then we can hear them. Plus, does a woman have the mental, emotional, and physical strength to preside over a country? If there is a war, I put my body in the way and defend my wife. I don't ask her to defend me. Is the woman's body as strong as a man's?
Also in Tahrir Square was Abdel Fattah Arafa, a young lawyer who was passing out flyers supporting the women's demands. He said he acknowledges the role women played in the Egyptian revolution and that some women even died during those protests. But he's also against a woman for president.
I support the women and am passing out flyers, but an Egyptian woman is more emotional than a European woman. The Egyptian woman can be a minister, but her emotions will overrun her if she is president. When Suzanne wanted to bring up her son Gamal Mubarak as president, she did it with emotions. Hosni did it through convincing steps, like a man would do.
With nearly 40% of the Egyptian population living just at or below the poverty line, some men said the demonstration for women's rights was ill-timed. Human rights activist and lawyer Dalia Zakhari disagrees.
We will not make a revolution every time we want to change or amendment the constitution or the laws. So this is the time. And why the women's rights should be not the priority?
While it may have taken just 18 days of protest to bring down Mubarak's regime, few expect the process of building democracy and equality to come as swiftly. Aya Batraoui, FSRN, Cairo.
Come see. Oh, what's done happened to me?
The West African nation of Nigeria is one of Africa's largest oil producers, and while the industry has created billions of dollars in revenue, it's also led to corruption, repression, and devastated the health and environment of many communities. But in the Niger Delta, women are fighting back. FSRN's Nicole Hummel files this report.
We are losing our children. The men are losing their wives. The wives are losing their husbands. So we stood and said, no more. No more to violence. No more to conflict. We want peace.
Stella Chuku is a community activist with Kebetkashe Women Development and Resource Center, an organization that is working to expose the issues faced by women in the Niger Delta. This oil-rich region of Nigeria is home to 20 million people and 40 different ethnic groups, and has been devastated by 50 years of oil exploitation.
We want food on our table. We need our people around us, our families. We don't want conflict anymore.
Chukwu is one of the many women in the Niger Delta who have decided to take matters into their own hands to fight the oil exploitation that has destroyed the ecosystem and impacted the lives of millions of people.
Women on the march again. Asking for environmental justice.
Nigeria is Africa's largest oil-producing country, and an estimated 40% of its crude oil exports are destined for the United States. But Western-based oil companies, in collaboration with the Nigerian authorities, have neglected to address the environmental and social problems that local communities have faced as a result of this oil extraction. Windy Grace Mamo is a member of the Federation of Ogoni Women Associations, a platform of action for Ogoni women to express themselves and mobilize against oppressive actions of the government and oil companies.
How we could sustain life in this region is not a question of concern to the oil-producing companies like Shell that is operating particularly in Ogoni land. All they are after is their profits.
The Ogoni people gained recognition in the 1990s because of an ongoing confrontation with Shell Oil, which was accused of collaborating in the government's execution of writer and activist Ken Saro-Wiwa and eight other leaders of the tribe. Although a settlement was reached 14 years later, other problems have persisted. Oil spills, waste dumping, and gas flaring are endemic in the Niger Delta region, where 60% of the people depend on the natural environment for their livelihood. Hundreds of oil spills occur every year, and according to Amnesty International, some 2,000 sites have been registered as contaminated by the country's National Oil Spill Detection and Response Agency. Again, Mamo.
The people of Ogoni land, especially the women, their most sustainable life or livelihoods are on fishing and farming. So, due to the rate of pollution on both land and the creek, the agricultural practice can no longer be effective.
According to a number of human rights organizations, the pollution has led to serious health issues for the local communities. The life expectancy in the Niger Delta region is the lowest in Nigeria, at just over 40 years old. This environmental exploitation and poor living standards have led some people from the Niger Delta to take up arms since the late 90s to try and fight oil companies off their lands. But local authorities deployed security forces in the region to fight the militant activists, resulting in endemic violence within communities of the region. Maman says women have been particularly affected by this violence.
Women were dumped in the prison. Our girls were taken by the military men and they pregnant them, misused them, and dumped them.
As April's presidential elections approach, the country's current leader, Goodluck Jonathan, is assuring Deltans of his administration's commitment to sustainable development, infrastructure, and social programs. But many in the region are doubtful that change will come from the male-dominated government structure. MMJ Okon is the founder and executive director of Kebit Kashe Women's Center.
For the Niger Delta issue to be truly resolved, that women have to be part of it. And when we say women, we don't think it's just any woman. We feel that women that are directly impacted, women that have been marginalized over the years, women that don't have any godfathers, that they are the people that will sincerely drive the process of change in the Niger Delta.
Far from remaining silent victims, these women are organizing to voice the injustice faced by their communities and fighting for a brighter future. The center focuses on human rights, reproductive health, HIV education, and environmental justice. Their projects include peace education for youth and civic education intended to engage women in voting, budgeting, and engaging with political candidates. Nevertheless, Okon says that it has been a challenge to raise awareness about this women-led struggle.
At the local level, women have been taking actions to engage with oil companies to speak about their condition, but most of these actions at the local government have not been reported in the media.
Realizing the role that media can play in the Niger Delta struggle, Kebet Kashe has taken steps to develop media literacy among the communities it serves. In February, 15 women affiliated with the organization traveled to Dakar in Senegal to participate in the Indie Media Convergence and develop media production skills. Stella Chukwu also leads campaigns against violence through the radio, a medium that is popular and accessible in Nigeria.
I'm one of the women that mobilized women to use media, talk on radio, you know, to tell people about conflict and violence, how to stop them, you know.
Much lies ahead as these women continually face off with the broken promises of the government, harassment and repression by military forces, and an overall reluctance by the government and oil companies to engage women in discussions to develop sustainable solutions. But Maman is dedicated to the struggle.
I will not stop the fight until women of Okoniland are given their rights.
Nicole Hummel, FSRN.
Today in Atlanta, Georgia, women's and human rights activists hosted an event in front of the state capitol to celebrate 100 years of struggle led by immigrant women. They're also calling on lawmakers to reject legislation attacking immigrant women's human rights. At the turn of the last century, immigrant women led many of the fights against injustice and poor working conditions. Today, they still face numerous difficulties. Copycat versions of Arizona's controversial immigration bill, legal obstacles to an education, and domestic abuse are just some of the issues. Azadeh Shah Shahani is director of the Immigrants' Rights Project for Georgia's ACLU, and she joins me now. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us about your event. How did it go?
Oh, it went great. We had representatives from about a dozen women's rights and human rights organizations. It was a celebration, and women's rights and human rights advocates had come together to call on Georgia legislators to reject legislation attacking immigrant women.
To start with, what range of different ethnic communities comprise Georgia's immigrant women?
It's really a very diverse community. It's obviously, from Latin American countries, but also from, South Asia, from the Caribbean, from Africa, from the Middle East, people from all over the world.
What are some of the issues facing these immigrant groups, the women in particular?
Yeah, racial profiling is, always a big issue in Georgia. Some various forms of local police and federal government collaboration. So in Georgia, we have four counties that have 287 G agreements in place. If Arizona copycat bills were to pass, which currently we have three versions of the Arizona copycat bill pending in Georgia, then you would have that problem replicated all across Georgia. And, the laws would in effect turn Georgia into show me your papers territory, because they would give the police the power to walk up to someone and if, let's say, in the course of a traffic offense or jaywalking, to ask them for their documents. And, that, we believe, would, definitely also lead to racial profiling.
That program you mentioned, 287G, a university student who's the daughter of Mexican immigrants, Jessica Colottal, has been the focus of the immigration debate in your state. She's facing a possible jail term for making a false statement when she was picked up for what the police say was a routine traffic stop. Can you tell us about that case and how it ties into this 287G program in Cobb County?
So Jessica Colodo was a college student, and she came here when she was very young with her parents. She's undocumented. She was pulled over because she was pulled over, and then she couldn't produce a driver's license. She ended up in Cobb County, and Cobb County is one of the 287G counties, and then subsequently she ended up in detention and was about to be deported before the federal government decided to grant her a deferral and basically defer her deportation for about a year. So, you know, again, that pinpoints the huge problem with 287G targeting, you know, students and gifted, gifted students and hardworking members of the community who are going about their business, you know, being targeted by this program. Whereas, you know, the stated purpose of 287G was to make our community safer. It has definitely backfired. And, you know, we have documented the problem in Cobb and Gwinnett counties in Georgia, showing that 287G has actually led to less safe communities because, you know, when the police are given increasing power to enforce immigration laws, then that's going to make the community afraid to talk to the police if they face a problem.
So what would you like to see done to improve that or change that situation, that lack of trust between immigrant communities and the local authorities that presumably is more of an issue when it comes to immigrant women?
Definitely. I mean, you know, we believe that the 287G agreements in Georgia should be repealed. You know, local organizations that work with survivors of domestic violence, what they have said is that, you know, in counties with 287G, survivors of domestic violence are, you know, increasingly afraid to contact the police and to even contact organizations that help survivors of domestic violence or, you know, other crimes. Because, again, they're afraid that, you know, talking to a figure of authority might somehow land them in deportation proceedings.
What do you see as the challenges in providing a legal framework to help immigrant women who are victims of domestic abuse?
The larger problem is that, you know, our immigration laws and our immigration system is broken. You know, there is a need for comprehensive immigration reform, for, you know, humane laws to be put into place. And what you have instead is that, you know, states such as Georgia are trying to create, you know, their own immigration laws, leading to a patchwork of, you know, a patchwork of state laws that don't work, that are unconstitutional, and that are, you know, in contradiction to fundamental American values, and that also, you know, as I mentioned, make our communities less safe because, you know, survivors of crimes, witnesses to crimes, such as survivors of domestic violence, human trafficking, other crimes, and crimes of violence, you know, particularly impacting women, are afraid to talk to the police.
Azadeh Shahshahani, Director of the Immigrants' Rights Project for Georgia's ACLU, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. Thanks to KPFA, Nathan Moore, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.